Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Many of you are probably familiar with the phrase deus ex machina. Here's a brief explanation from Fandor.
You know when you're watching a movie and the characters really get themselves into a jam, and you wonder, how the hell are they going to get themselves out of this mess? And then, something like this happens.
Eagles! The eagles are coming!
This is referred to as a deus ex machina. Deus ex machina is a term applied to a situation where the problem seems unsolvable, yet it is solved by an unlikely occurrence. So in other words, lazy writing.
Deus ex machina translates as God from the machine, and it harkens back to ancient Greek theater, where actors playing gods would be lowered onto the stage by cranes to resolve conflicts after playwrights had painted themselves into corners. In the prosecution of Frederick Freeman, the prosecution found itself painted into a similar corner. And so, at the very end of the case, the state pulled out an actual deus ex machina, claiming that Frederick Freeman was a literal god from the machine.
Hi and welcome to Undisclosed, the state versus Frederick Freeman. This is the second episode in a four-episode series about Frederick Freeman, who was convicted of the 1986 murder of Scott Macklem. I'm Rabia Chaudhry. I'm an attorney and author of Adnan's Story. And as always, I'm joined by my co-hosts Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, I'm Susan Simpson, and I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
In episode one, we laid out the pickle that the prosecution found itself in during the prosecution of Frederick Freeman for the 1986 murder of St. Clair Community College student Scott Macklem. Recall that witnesses testify that it would take 6.5 hours to drive from Escanaba, Michigan on the Upper Peninsula to the community college in Port Huron on the Lower Peninsula on a good day. Although Beth Steyer didn't testify at trial, Paul DeMars placed Freeman in a jump-started Burgundy Mercury Marquis at a Bob's Big Boy in Escanaba a mere 6.5 hours before Freeman was supposedly seen outside the community college. Meanwhile, three witnesses with interlocking memories placed Freeman at a karate studio in Escanaba just 3 hours after the murder. And two more witnesses placed Freeman outside the store called the Treasure Chest in Escanaba between 6 and 6.5 hours after the murder, with Michelle Woodworth and her yellow Mercury Marquis. Given this compelling alibi evidence, the state had to place great weight on the testimony of their two eyewitnesses, before having to rely on a literal deus ex machina at the end of their case. Let's start with the state's most compelling witness, Renee Gobin.
As a St. Clair County prosecutor would later admit, without Gobin, quote, we had no case at all. Gobin was a criminal justice major who later became an investigator with the Oakland County Prosecutor's Office in Michigan. As we noted in episode one, Gobin didn't see the murder and thought the shotgun blast that took Macklem's life was a tire blowing out. But shortly after the shooting, at about 9 a.m., he did see a mystery man driving out of the community college parking lot where the murder occurred. Port Huron Police Officer James Carmody pulled Gobin out of one of his classes at 10:45 a.m. on the morning of the murder and interviewed him in one of his professor's offices at the community college. According to the police report, Gobin gave the following description of the driver. He was a white male, about 25 years old, wearing a green army jacket and a dark blue ski mask. with the red mouth portion pulled down to his eyebrows. Dark hair. The police report then notes, quote, no further information on the physical of the driver. Gobin also gave a description of the car. Small, possibly a foreign make vehicle, maybe a Mazda. Pinkish tan or dark tan in color. Clean, in good condition, and making no noises. Gobin says he wrote down the license plate number on a folder as 822-DHH, although he may have gotten the last letter wrong. Comrie ran the plates, and they came up as a match for a vehicle owned by a jeweler in Mount Clemens, Michigan, who had no apparent connection to the murder. So, you have the state's key eyewitness, and he may be off on the license plate in the car driven by the killer by just one letter. What do you do? In this case, the answer was hypnosis. Here's part of my call with Dr. Thomas Mooney, a psychology professor at St. Clair Community College in 1986.
I drive into school. I think the faculty parking lot is closed, being redone or something. I'm parking in the student lot, and I see this tape up there. So I'm walking in to, I have a class in what was called the North Building. And I get to the door, and there's Officer James Carmody. Jim's an old student of mine, knew him well. I said, Jim, what's going on? Tom, we've had a killing in the parking lot. For a fact, the only eyewitness is in your class. Now, you're kidding, Jim. Oh, my gosh. So I go up to class, and we talk a bit about the case. Finish class, I talk to the young man. And I had just read within the last 6 months, article in Time. There was a kidnapping of a bus out in California.
This article was referring to a 1976 mass kidnapping in Chowchilla, California. Here's a clip from CBS This Morning.
Three masked gunmen seized a bus carrying 26 children and their driver. Back in 1976, the kidnappers drove them 100 miles from Chowchilla, California to a rock quarry. They buried the children and the driver alive 12 feet underground in a moving truck. While the driver and children managed to dig themselves out, the 28-hour nightmare still haunts them more than 40 years later.
As noted in the Time article, under hypnosis, the bus driver was able to remember the license plate number on one of the vans that took them to the quarry, which ultimately led to the apprehension of the abductors. And so Dr. Mooney thought that he could do something similar here. He took Rene Gobin to his office and hypnotized him.
And so what's the method that you used to hypnotize him? Do you remember?
Body tension, body relaxation, starting with the forehead, the cheeks, the neck, the shoulders, the arms, the chest, the back, the hips, the legs, and then counting backwards from 99 with every count that you take back, you go deeper into this very pleasant state. You're in control the whole time. You can never be too relaxed.
With Gobin hypnotized, Dr. Mooney then asked him to remember his day from the moment he woke up. And when Gobin got to the part where he saw the man driving the car, Dr. Mooney told him the following.
Rene, slow the tape down. You are looking at this guy. Slow the tape. Stop it. Describe what the guy looks like. Well, he's got a cap on and he's got a beard. Okay. Start that tape. Let the car go. The car's passing you. Look at the back. Look at the license. So he was able to think of maybe three or four different license plate or numbers. I take the tape down to the PHPD, and I bump into another former student of mine, John Bowens. I said, John, I've just interviewed the witness. Here's a description of the car, the possible license plates.
So was this type of hypnosis something that Dr. Mooney frequently did?
And is this something that you did regularly at the time?
No.
hypnosis?
Something I would never do again.
One thing that Dr. Mooney did do correctly was to record the hypnosis session.
Now I understand somebody took the tape.
Yeah, we don't know where the tape is. I have the transcript.
What happened?
That's right. The official status of the recording of the hypnosis session is missing. But there is a transcript of that session, and Colin reached out to Dr. Stephen Lin, the leading expert on hypnotically refreshed testimony, to review it.
I've testified in a lot of cases. I've published, I don't know, maybe 100, 150 articles on hypnosis. I'm not sure how many on hypnosis and memory, but many. So, yeah, so I have a pretty, extensive background in that. Yeah, I've testified in a lot of high-profile cases, both cases that are criminal cases and non-criminal cases.
And so generally speaking, do you have sort of a holistic overall take on hypnotically refreshed testimony and statements?
Yeah, well, sure. The effect of hypnosis is to increase the overall volume of memory, so you get more accurate memories, somewhat more, but more inaccurate memories. There are a lot of false memories that are mixed in, a lot of guesses turn into fairly confidently held beliefs. There's now pretty sizable literature showing that there are risks of both false memories and unwarranted confidence in memory. So those are the two kind of central findings that have made courts quite skeptical of the use of hypnosis. In fact, I think 27 states have banned hypnotically elicited testimony, and another 9 have procedural guidelines. So it's admitted on a case-by-case basis.
And looking at that breakdown, do you think this is something where, if you're able to comment, it should be banned per se, or that with certain safeguards, it can be used in certain scenarios?
Well, I would ban it per se. I mean, I think that it's very difficult to argue that certain safeguards mitigate risks necessarily, because research has not really been done on it. But even when you warn people that hypnosis can produce false memories, you have problems there.
So what about the hypnosis in this case? Recall that when Gobin started remembering the car and the driver, Dr. Mooney told him to, quote, stop the tape and free associate.
When you tell somebody that they can basically view a tape, that's not how memory works. You can't slow memories down. You can't zoom in terms of free associating. That's like one of the worst things that I've ever heard, just basically free associate. I mean, that's really horrible.
Colin then asked Dr. Lin to comment on the beginning of the hypnosis session, when Dr. Mooney asked Gobin to recall his day by doing, quote, kind of an out-of-body astral projection kind of thing.
The whole idea that you can astral project and leave your body. Well, all these kinds of suggestions, you know, really would lead one to be overly confident in whatever they were called, whether it was accurate or inaccurate or just a flat-out guess, right? So these are really confidence-building techniques. And a person would think, well, if this is really like a videotape or a tape or whatever, that I can roll forward or backward, then whatever I recall will be accurate, because what you see on a videotape or tape is an accurate rendition of what happened. You know, so these are really, really techniques that we know of today are really highly leading, in the sense that they lead one to believe that memory is something that it's not.
And what about the fact that Gobin was being hypnotized by his professor?
And in this case, the person being hypnotized is a community college student, and the person doing the hypnosis is their professor. Does that add any other wrinkles to it in terms of suggestibility?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's violating a procedural guideline right there.
Colin finished the conversation by asking Dr. Lin the following.
From what you've seen, how would you rate this compared to the other types of hypnotic refresh testimony you've seen?
Well, I mean, I've seen a lot of really bad examples of hypnotically refreshed memories, but this ranks close to the bottom, I would say. I mean, this really is an egregious example of how not to use hypnosis, right? Yeah, and I think there were really leading questions around, a car or a vehicle actually suggesting maybe it was a Honda or this kind of car or whatever, you know. So you've got all the elements there, right? You've got the leading questions, the myth of the memory being like a tape recorder. You've got the implications of, associated with inflated confidence. So that's really bad, right? So I think you can make a very strong case that this was very, very poorly done. And on that basis, I don't know details how confident the person was prior to the hypnosis, what the person saw, which is part of the guidelines. You're supposed to get a very clear and specific statement regarding pre-hypnotic recollections, right?
This last part of Dr. Lynn's statement was key in the Frederick Freeman case. At the time of Freeman's trial, Michigan courts did not allow for the admission of hypnotically refreshed testimony. But if an eyewitness made a statement before being hypnotized, and a judge was satisfied that the eyewitness's trial testimony was based on what he saw and not based on facts that were implanted or suggested during hypnosis, the eyewitness could testify. And this is indeed what the judge in Freeman's case found. But let's ourselves rewind the tape. Recall that in his pre-hypnosis police statement, Gobin said the car he saw was foreign, maybe a Mazda. As Dr. Lynn noted during the hypnosis session, Dr. Mooney asked Gobin leading questions about the car. Specifically, he asked, quote, "What make of car is this? Ford? A Chevy? Are you able to play that tape back? What was that and see what kind of car it is?" And guess what? Gobin leaves the hypnosis session convinced that the car he saw was not a foreign car like a Mazda, but a very American Ford Escort station wagon. And then there's a license plate number. In his pre-hypnosis statement, Gobin said it was 822-DHH. During the hypnosis session, Dr. Mooney suggests several alternatives. For example, at one point, without any prompting by Gobin, Dr. Mooney asks if the last three letters could be DSO. Or DHM, and Gobin answers that both are possible. Gobin ends up giving 12 different license plate numbers, none of which have any connection to Fred Freeman. And then there's the biggest leading question. There's only mention of the driver having dark hair in the police report of Gobin's pre-hypnosis statement, and no mention of facial hair. And this can't really be written off as Officer Carmody only writing down some of what Gobin told him. As noted in the police report, Carmody listed the features shared by Gobin and then wrote, "No further information on the physical of the driver." But now, fast forward to the hypnosis session. With no prior mention of facial hair by Gobin, Dr. Mooney asks, "Now he's got a beard too?" And Gobin responds, "I think so. He's got dark hair. I know that." But did Gobin even know that?
At some point on November 5th, the day that Scott Macklin was shot, Gobin returned to the community college parking lot, saw a man in a rusty silver car with Florida license plates, and ended up telling the police something. At trial, the defense tried to claim that Gobin clearly identified this man as the same man he saw driving away after the Macklin shooting, while the state and Gobin tried to claim that Gobin just said this man kind of resembled the earlier driver. Specifically, Gobin claimed that the thing that linked this Florida man with the driver he saw earlier was that, quote, "he had dark hair, same thickness of beard. It was dark colored." While the jury never heard anything more, documents obtained since trial make it tough to believe the police took what Gobin said as anything other than a serious lead. The police were able to connect the vehicle, a silver Buick with Florida plates, to a man named James Kilbourne, and went to his house twice, once 4 days after Macklin's murder, and the second time a few months later. During that second trip, the Port Huron police were able to interview Kilbourn about why he was in the community college parking lot on the day of Macklin's murder. The interview notes also state the following, quote, "It may also be noted that Kilbourn has long, curly, blonde hair, thin, and has a heavy mustache." That's right. Goldman says he's certain the man driving after the murder had dark hair, and the one thing linking that man and the Florida man was the dark hair on their faces and beards. But James Kilbourn had blonde hair, which makes you further question Goldman's memory and what effect the hypnosis might have had in it.
In any event, 2 days later, on November 7th, 1986, Goldman made a second police statement and was shown a photo array, although the order of these two events is unclear. In the photo array, he picked out Frederick Freeman's photo, which showed him with a thick, dark mustache and a thin beard. And in the report on Goldman's second statement, Goldman describes the driver as having dark hair, a mustache, and the start of a beard. Later, Goldman picks Freeman out of a lineup. Colin asked Timujin Kinsu what he recalled about this lineup.
This is not the lineup you see on television, where there's a big glass wall, and, you know, you stand up and you step forward and talk and all that. This is what Port Huron had. In the basement of the St. Clair County Jail, they had a tiny wooden platform with a little piece of black cloth in front of it. They did not have an actual lineup area like you see in all the television shows. Okay? They put us up on the stage, and there's these guys there. There's this little, like, orange-haired, midget-looking guy. And I'm like, what is going on here? I know that in a lineup, everyone's supposed to look alike. And there's this black cloth. And so I can hear and see everything. You're not supposed to be able to see anything, of course. I can hear and see everything. These people are like 2 feet from me talking through a thin black sheet with a light on the sheet. So before they put the lights on the stage area, the little wooden platform, the lights are on where they're at. I can see everybody. I can see what they're doing. I can hear them. Crystal clarity. So I literally watched Rennie Gobain walk up to me, and he looked at me, and then he didn't even look, didn't even pay any attention to me. He wasn't looking at me, he wasn't looking at my face, he wasn't studying me. This is what I hear. I wrote this in my affidavit. He never denied it. He goes, well, I know him, and I know him, and I know the guy you're looking for has got brown hair, and he's like literally looking all around, and he's looking down at Loxton on the end there, and which everybody else picked up, and he's looking and looking and looking at him, and then he goes, oh, I think he's got shorter hair. And then he looks back at me and he goes, oh, I'll say him. That was the big identification. So I hear this. And again, I was young. I didn't care. I was having a fit. I was like, this is illegal. What is this? I can see him. This is ridiculous. You know, and they're like, shut up, be quiet. And I'm like telling my lawyer, do something. What are you doing? This is insane. So now, just so you know, to show you that I told the truth when I wrote that affidavit, it turned out he actually admitted he did know two of the people in the lineup. And they were cops. This guy had intimate involvement with the police. He wanted to be a cop forever. He hung out at the cop shop. He was associated with these guys all the time, and that's why he knew the two guys in the lineup. They put two cops in the lineup.
It's impossible to corroborate everything Kinsu says about the lineup, but his claim about how the lineup was conducted is corroborated by Richard Krueger, the other state eyewitness. And yes, Rene Goldman did know two of the six people in the lineup who were both police officers. Goldman would eventually testify against Freeman at trial and add another physical characteristic that was not in either of his two police statements, that the driver had a nose that was too big for his face. At trial, we can also see how the defense tried to establish that Goldman could not have identified the driver. On the stand, Goldman acknowledged that he only saw the driver's face for 5 seconds as the car drove past him. And Goldman admitted again that the driver had a ski mask pulled down to his eyebrows. And he added that the collar of the driver's green jacket was pulled up to cover the bottom of his face. Finally, Goldman testified that the driver had his head down and appeared to be trying to conceal his face with his hand. So, could you make out an identification of someone under these circumstances? That was the question posed to the jurors.
Step
into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
As noted in a Metro Times story on the Freeman case, one of the jurors said, quote, "The thing that finally convinced me was the testimony of Rene Gobin." But what about the testimony of the state's second eyewitness, Richard Krueger? In episode 1, we reported that Richard Krueger saw a suspicious man by the community college at about 8:01 a.m., or about an hour before the murder. According to a police report of an interview conducted 2 days after the Macklin murder, Krueger said the suspicious man had a green army jacket and pull-down hat and might have had a light beard that was neatly trimmed. According to Krueger, the suspicious person, quote, "acted like he was on a mission going to war." But recall that Krueger was not a student and did not park in the student parking lot where Scott Macklin was shot. Instead, he was attending a supportive employment symposium and he parked in an adjacent city lot. Looking at photos of these two lots, Krueger's estimate in his police statement that he got, quote, "as close as 100 feet from the suspicious man" seems accurate. Given this, you might wonder about the specificity of Krueger's description. And Colin did too. He reached out to Jeffrey Loftus, the leading expert on eyewitness identifications from different distances. Specifically, Loftus wrote an article after conducting a number of studies with Aaron Harley to test what's known as the, quote, "distance as filtering hypothesis," which posits that as a face is viewed at further and further distances, facial details become coarser, meaning that there's less ability to detect the details of the face. These studies involve celebrity faces, and the ability to recognize those faces was close to 100% through a distance of about 25 feet. Gradually fading to zero at 110 feet. Loftus conducted these studies by concluding that, quote, "when you make an image smaller, you lose information in exactly the same way as happens when you keep the picture large but make it blurry." And that's now exactly what he does for juries at trials.
It's actually an article that I've been able to rely on a fair amount in cases that I've participated in. So, you know, judges seem perfectly willing to accept it, reasonable evidence. And it's been fairly compelling when I've testified because I've been able to construct the kind of visual images that appear in the article and show them to the jury and say, look, you know, this witness looking at the perpetrator from X feet away would have had at best this amount of visual information available to them. And then they look at, the jury gets to look at one of these blurred pictures and, you know, are told that even if everything else was perfect, even if the witness had an indefinite amount of time, even if the witness was paying rapt attention to the perpetrator's appearance, even if it were, you know, bright sunlight, this is still the best the visual system would have been able to do in terms of acquiring information about what the perpetrator looked like. So, you know, there you have it. You decide, jury, whether this would have been a sufficiently good memory representation for the witness to later recognize the suspect from a lineup or whatever.
And so basically, when you come into court, you have, depending upon the distance they've given, an image that is sufficiently blurred based upon the distance, and you display that to the jury and give the testimony you just explained, right?
Right, exactly.
Other experts in the field of eyewitness identifications agree. For example, Willem Wagner and Juliet von der Schrier conducted tests and determined that the proportion of correct eyewitness identifications to errors was too great at distances over 15 meters or 49 feet to be reliable. And Jennifer Dysart, another expert in the field, has summarized studies to conclude that distances of 100 feet or more, quote, make it extremely difficult to encode the details of a person's face, which is required in order to make accurate identification decisions. All of which goes to say that Krueger's minute descriptions based on his estimate that he got no closer than 100 feet from the suspect individual, well, suspect. Nonetheless, Krueger was shown the same photo array as Gobin and also selected Frederick Freeman. But then, a funny thing happened at the lineup. Krueger did not select Freeman. Instead, he selected another man, James Loxton. I asked Ken Sue about what he remembered about this.
As far as the way he was acting, this is what he was doing. He was going, "Oh my God, it's so hot down here. These lights are ridiculous. I can't see anything." And they go, "Well, just try, sir, just try." And he goes, "I don't see anybody that looks like who I'm looking for. I don't see anybody like that." He keeps going on and on, whining and protesting. "It's so hot. Oh, can we do this later on? Oh my God." And then finally he goes, "Okay, him." And he points to the end. And you can see them go, "Are you sure? Are you sure that's the guy?" And then they're getting upset, you know. And he goes, "Yes, if it's anybody, it's him right there, that guy right there." And that was the identification of that individual.
Now, you might be tempted to think this is an exaggeration, but it's what Krueger testified to at trial. Here are some selections of his trial testimony talking about the lineup.
"They were behind a black screen with a lot of light. It just seemed inappropriate. It was very hot. We were in a basement. It was very uncomfortable. I commented on it. We stood in a very uncomfortable antechamber where there were sinks. As far as I was concerned, not appropriate for a lineup."
According to Krueger, he just wanted to get out of there. So he picked the person who looked most like the person he saw in the parking lot. But again, that person was not Frederick Freeman, despite the fact that he was in the lineup. It was James Loxton. And Loxton definitely does not resemble Freeman.
And so how would you characterize the differences in appearance between yourself and James Loxton?
James Loxton, in person, he looked like a kind of a cross between a Native American and an Italian. He had that kind of swarthy, greasy thing going on, you know? And, you know, you could just tell, I mean, I've been locked up a long time. You could tell when somebody's just like a dope fiend scumbag, and this guy had like dope fiend scumbag written all over him. You know, I look like a dorky, nerdy, I had a little punk rock shag haircut. You know, I'm like a little, we just call them beboppers, you know? This guy looked like your typical heroin addict. You know, he just had that greaseball, stringy, dope fiend thing, you know? He was wiry, he was skinny, he had jacked teeth. You know, the little mustache. He just looked like a little dope fiend. Nothing like me at all. I mean, especially far more different in person. And when Larry Gunter, the cop, found out that they had picked that guy out, they used to take me. I was almost never allowed to bathe. But Larry was one of the cool ones, and he would try to get me out to bathe. And they would take me to this trustee pod, and that guy was there. And I confronted him while I was in there. And I said, "Listen, man, did you have something to do with that murder? Because, you know, people picked you out, dude. You look nothing like me." And he literally ran from me to the other end of the pod and was hiding in the back of the pod while I went to take my shower.
Looking at the photos of the two, we can confirm that this is accurate. However, despite the lineup snafu, the prosecution called Krueger at Freeman's preliminary hearing, and he identified Freeman at the defense table as the man he saw in the parking lot. On cross-examination, defense counsel asked Krueger whether he was informed that Freeman was not the person he picked out of the lineup. Krueger answers no, but adds that this mistaken identification wouldn't reduce his confidence at all.
Two other interesting things happen at the preliminary hearing. First, as noted, Rene Gobin says the driver he saw was wearing a green army jacket and dark blue ski mask. Of course, in his police statement, Krueger said that the man he saw was wearing a green army jacket and a hat. Understandably, the prosecution wanted to establish that these two eyewitnesses both saw the same man. But Krueger testifies that the man's hat was a seaman's cap, likely green. And on cross-examination, the following exchange takes place.
"Now this fatigue coat, are you talking about an army fatigue coat? Do you know what I mean by army supply or army surplus, green fatigue coat? Is that what it is?"
"It's more modern than that."
"So when you say green fatigue, you mean the color green fatigue. It's a color of a coat similar to an army issue."
"Well, they issue 4 or 5 different colors. It wasn't a combat fatigue coat."
"It was more of a puffy ski jacket, or at least a winter sort of jacket?"
"Something more winterish."
All of which goes to say that Gobin and Krueger may have seen the same man, but it's far from a certainty. The second interesting thing at the preliminary hearing is that Krueger changes his distance. Now, Krueger claims that he got within 50 to 70 feet of the suspect man. But at trial, he would reduce the distance even more, saying he was a short distance from the man, maybe 40 or 50, 60 feet. And despite the fact that this seems impossible, given that Krueger was in a different parking lot, the changes go unchecked by defense counsel David Dean. While this omission was glaring, there's something else that was definitely not David Dean's fault. Colin recently spoke to Herb Welser, who has worked to prove that the Port Huron Police Department got the wrong guy in the Scott Macklem case. For Welser, this has been quite a career shift, given his prior job.
So, I worked for the Port Huron Police Department just under 31 years. I started as a cadet at the police department in 1974.
After retiring from the Port Huron Police Department in 2005, Welser got a call in 2008 from Bill Proctor, a local TV reporter who was covering Freeman's appeal.
Bill Proctor contacted me and let me know that he had an appointment with the Port Huron Police Department in 2008 to go into the police department to view the evidence box and folders that were there. So myself, Bill Proctor, and Fred's wife, Amica, went to the police department and looked through the file, and that's when we found in the file the photographs that were used in the photo lineup.
And when you see these photos that are used in the lineup, were there things that immediately jumped out to you?
Absolutely. When I saw those photographs were used, there was four photographs of persons that had been arrested by the Port Huron Police Department, which showed on those photographs a placard that stated Port Huron Police on it. And then there was a photograph of Fred Freeman, which stated Pleasant Ridge Police Department. And there was many, many other differences in the photograph of Fred Freeman compared to the four photographs with Port Huron Police arrest.
And so, Freeman's defense called in Jennifer Dysart, one of the eyewitness experts we mentioned earlier in the episode. And she corroborated Welser's initial impression when testifying at Freeman's habeas hearing. According to Dysart, it was clear that Freeman's two photos came from a different source than the two photos of the four other men in the photo array. First, his photos had dark lines behind them, while the other photos had a solid color in the background. Second, in one photo, Freeman was facing forward, and in the other, his head was turned to the right, while the four other men were facing forward in one photo and had their bodies turned entirely to the left in the other photo. Third, as Welser noted, Freeman's placard came from the Pleasant Ridge Police Department, while the other four men had placards from the Port Huron Police Department. And fourth, Freeman's photos had a gap between them, while the other four men had a dark line between their photos.
Dysart testified that these were substantial differences that drew attention to Freeman's photo and made it stand out. She then concluded that in hundreds of photo arrays that she's reviewed, she's never seen one so suggestive. Now at this point, you may wonder why this wouldn't have been so obvious to David Dean, and why this wasn't his fault. And the answer is that the photo array that Proctor and Welser uncovered was not the photo array turned over to the defense, or shown to the jury at trial. Instead, the defense and the jury were given a different version of the photo array that removed the substantial differences from the one shown to the actual eyewitnesses. And Dysart concluded that both the photo arrays shown to the eyewitnesses could have influenced the subsequent identifications of Freeman by both Gobin and Krueger, and that the average juror would never have thought that the photo array that was introduced into evidence was suggestive. Dysart then added the simple but poignant conclusion, quote, "I believe the jury was misled." And it's clear that the photo array was important to the jurors. During deliberations, they sent a note to the judge asking to see the photo array again. So, being shown the altered photo array could well have changed their verdict, especially given that they started in a 6-6 deadlock. Now, at this point, you may be wondering, this was a crowded community college parking lot. Wouldn't there have been more witnesses to the Macklem shooting and its aftermath? The answer is yes, and some of them testified at trial. But like Gobin, they thought that the shotgun blast that took Macklem's life was a firecracker or a tire blowing out, and they didn't have much meaningful to say.
But there was one more eyewitness to the aftermath of the Macklin murder, and she was not shown the photo array, although she did take part in the police lineup. That eyewitness was 19-year-old Kathy Ballard, who went to the community college in the morning and worked at Wendy's in the afternoon. In her police statement, Ballard said that between 8:55 and 9 a.m. on November 5th, she heard what sounded like a firecracker, and something she would repeat at both the preliminary hearing and trial. She heard a yell like a man trying to sound like a woman. Then, like Gobin, Ballard testified to a car driving by her, which she described as a small, compact-sized car, possibly a Horizon or Chevette, that was reddish-brown in color. And like Gobin, Ballard testified the driver was trying to conceal his face with his hand, although she was able to describe him as a white male, around 19 years old, with dark hair. Now, for whatever reason, Ballard was not shown the photo array, but again, she did take part in the police lineup, where she wasn't able to identify anyone. Moreover, at Freeman's preliminary hearing, Ballard also wasn't able to identify him as the driver. But then at trial, things got interesting. On direct examination, the prosecutor asked Ballard about an epiphany she had at the preliminary hearing. In response, Ballard testified that something clicked, although she didn't verbalize it at the time. She said that when she saw Frederick Freeman at that hearing, she just knew he was the guy she had seen at the far right of the police lineup. And for Ballard, there was something about that man's demeanor at the lineup. His body language, his attitude, the impression he was laughing, like it was a joke. Ballard was able to connect this behavior by the man on the far right of the lineup to the attitude the driver displayed in the parking lot in the morning of the murder, like he had just played a practical joke. For Ballard, the connection was uncanny, jarring even. At this point, you might be thinking, damn, maybe Frederick Freeman did defy the laws of time and physics to commit this murder despite all of his alibi witnesses. But then, on cross-examination, David Dean confronted Ballard with a harsh reality. The man in the far right of the lineup was not Frederick Freeman. It was James Loxton.
So, obviously, the jury didn't know everything we've revealed, such as the suggestive photo array. But they did know this. None of the three eyewitnesses claimed to see the murder. Kathy Ballard could not identify Fred Freeman as the driver she saw and was startled by the similarity in demeanor between James Loxton and the driver. Richard Krueger picked James Loxton out of the photo lineup based on appearance, and Renee Gobin was hypnotized, changed key details of what he saw, and identified James Kilburn on the day of the shooting as someone who at least could have been the driver he'd seen. Meanwhile, the defense had all of the alibi witnesses that we detailed in episode 1. Oh, and speaking of alibis, you might have noticed that both Gobin and Ballard testified that the driver they saw was driving a small, maybe even a compact-sized car, while Fred Freeman was seen with two different Mercury Marquis hours before and after the murder. And for those of you who might not remember the Marquis or only recall the later models, the 270 models that Freeman and Woodworth had were huge.
And so, you know, people might have a different impression of what Marquis after. These are both in the 70s. Yours and the other.
Yeah, 76 and 77.
And so, what are the size of these? Yeah, what are the size of these vehicles?
These are enormous four-door boats. These are huge. They're like the size of Chrysler Imperial. They're giant square cars. They're both four-door cars. The burgundy one was kind of nice shape. It was purchased from an older gentleman who took really good care of it. The gold one was beat to death. I mean, the doors were dented. There were no hubcaps. It was a $100 piece of junk that we picked up at a little used car place in Flint, not far from where Shelley worked. Shelley worked at a Coney Island, and I want to say it was American. I think it was American Coney Island. She can tell you the name for sure. And this place was like just a couple doors down from the Coney Island. And we actually bought it like, I think 3 o'clock in the morning. The guy had a little used car lot next to his house. And we were walking everywhere, and Shelley'd saved some money up from tips. And so I knocked on the door, and fortunately he wasn't too upset. He sold me this big old junker. So we had that, and then later on we bought the burgundy one.
So clearly the prosecution was in deep trouble. There's no way that the clean, small car Gobin saw was the burgundy Marquis that Freeman had hours before the murder in Escanaba, and there was really no way that it was the janky yellow marquee that Freeman was seen in 6 to 6.5 hours after the murder in Escanaba. And that's even assuming that you ignore the 3 karate alibi witnesses who saw Freeman in Escanaba a mere 3 hours after Macklin was murdered in Port Huron. But the prosecutor couldn't make that assumption. And so, after the defense rested, the prosecutor asked to call a rebuttal witness, a pilot named Robert Evans, to create its own deus ex machina, a literal god from the machine that would save its case from ruin. The prosecutor's theory was as follows. 1. After Paul DeMars saw Freeman in the early morning hours of November 5th at Bob's Big Boy in Escanaba, Freeman could have driven to the Delta County Airport, a small county-owned public use airport in Escanaba. 2. Freeman could have prearranged a private plane to fly him down to the St. Clair County Airport, a small government-owned airport in Smiths Creek, Michigan. 3. Freeman could have had a car such as an Escort or a Chevette waiting for him at the St. Clair Airport. 4. Freeman could have driven that car about 47 miles to the community college in time to be seen by Kruger at 8:01 a.m., then shoot Macklem at 9 a.m., and then drive the 47 miles back to the airport where the private plane was waiting for him. 5. Freeman could have then flown back to the Delta County Airport in Escanaba. And then 6. Freeman could have driven down to downtown Escanaba in enough time to arrive at the karate studio and enough time to be seen by his 3 alibi witnesses at noon.
Of course, a prosecutor can't just call a witness or present a theory without foundation, so what did the prosecutor argue? Well, we'll get more into Freeman's arrest later, but for now, what you need to know is that after Freeman learned that his ex-girlfriend, Crystal Merrill, had accused him of murdering her new boyfriend, Scott Macklem, Freeman made a call to Crystal while the Port Huron police officers were there. And one of those officers, Sergeant Dave Hall, was taking notes. At trial, Hall would testify about the call, including the following.
Yes, he talked about that he wasn't in Port Huron. He kept trying to convince her I wasn't in Port Huron that day. I was in Escanaba. And if I was in Port Huron, you know, I was 560 miles away. And then he talked about, you know, how long it would take me to travel. He says I could drive in 8 hours, or I could take a ferry across to Green Bay, Wisconsin, or, you know, I could take an airplane out of any airport and make it in a couple of hours.
And that, according to the prosecutor, was the connective tissue needed to introduce its plane theory. Freeman, however, remembers the phone call very differently.
I wanted a donut shop. I believe it was a Winchell's, maybe. And I'm in this donut shop. And I go to the payphone in the donut shop. We didn't have, like, the phone cards and stuff you have nowadays. But you had, like, a phone card that had a number, like a code number. And you could bill stuff to your home phone. And so Billy had a call to my home phone. I call Crystal. And we start talking, and I'm like, why are you telling the police that I killed your boyfriend? And she's saying all this crazy stuff. And so I know people are listening. She's going like, remember that one time you had those poison darts? And I was like, what are you talking about, you whack job? So the cool thing is, in the notes from Dave Hall, who was allegedly listening to this call, he tries to testify at trial that I had said all this stuff, and he said he took it all from his notes. Well, we had a fight, but we got his notes, and you should have those now. They're attached to habeas. And in the notes, you'll see not a single thing he said that I said is in those notes.
The portion of Hall's notes that lines up best with his testimony is the following.
Wednesday morning, 560 miles from UNE, Green Bay, Wisconsin. Slept until 12 noon. Best spear. Paul. Purchases from treasure chest.
In other words, Freeman is saying how far away he was from the community college on the Wednesday of the murder, and mentioning his alibi witnesses, including Best Spear, which was presumably an attempt to name Beth Steyer, his date hours before the murder. And yes, there is a mention of Green Bay, Wisconsin, but no mention of a ferry or a plane. Suspiciously, Sergeant Hall did not make a report of his notes until 2 months after this phone call, well after the Port Huron police had spoken to Freeman's alibi witnesses and ostensibly knew that they precluded a drive to and from the community college. In pertinent part, that report stated,
he wanted to know what day of the week it was, and she stated it was Wednesday morning. He stated on Wednesday morning, I was 516 miles away from you in Escanaba. He also stated that he could have possibly flown out around from the airport. He got up there in a couple of hours, or he could have taken the ferry across Green Bay, Wisconsin.
It's unclear exactly what to make of these notes. There's no ferry that Freeman could have taken from Escanaba, Michigan, or Green Bay, Wisconsin to get anywhere near Port Huron and the community college. If anything, it seems like Freeman is saying he would have needed to do a couple-hour drive or take a ferry to Green Bay to fly out of Green Bay's airport to Port Huron. And indeed, it is about a two-hour drive from Escanaba to Green Bay, which lines up with a statement in the report that he could have gotten there, in other words, to Green Bay, in a couple of hours. Not that he could have gotten to Port Huron in a couple of hours.
But, as noted, that's not what Sergeant Hall testified to. He testified that Freeman could take an airplane out of any airport and make it to Port Huron in a couple hours. Of course, this also makes no sense, even being generous to the state, because Freeman only had one airport that could possibly work, the Delta County Airport in Escanaba. And so, despite Hall's evolving statement being the only shred of anything supporting the state's theory, the judge allowed testimony by Robert Evans, the pilot. Evans testified that you could charter a single-engine plane for a flight between the Delta County Airport and the St. Clair Airport for about $450. He also did two test trips, with one taking an hour and 37 minutes, and the other taking an hour and 40 minutes. Evans admitted that he checked the flight register at the Delta County Airport in Escanaba for the day of the murder and didn't see any unusual flights listed there. But he claimed the flight registers at both airports were voluntary, meaning that pilots didn't have to sign them. Evans, however, had to admit that he spoke to a group of the local pilots at the St. Clair Airport, and they all told him that they didn't fly anybody to or from Escanaba on the day of the murder. And so, that left the state arguing that Frederick Freeman was a literal god from the machine, able to travel to and from Port Huron in a private plane and a chartered car without a trace. It almost seems unfair to Freeman to dignify the state's deus ex machina, given that there's literally nothing to support it. But let's break down a couple of issues with it beyond the lack of evidence that it ever happened. First, could Freeman have afforded to charter this round-trip private flight with the pilot waiting hours for him while he committed the murder? Well, this would have been really difficult, given that he was scraping by, selling vitamins door-to-door, and qualified for appointed counsel.
When he got appointed your counsel, that means the court had to find that you were indigent, right?
Right, yeah, I had a hearing, and I testified at the hearing about what I had, and I testified very honestly, and they fought me brutally. They did not want me to have a lawyer of any kind. And it was funny because Dave Dean was crooked, and he was one of their snitches, but Ken Lord was fighting me big time at this hearing. And I said, dude, you guys have already been into my storage bin illegally twice. You've torn the thing apart. You know exactly what I've got. I mean, I was like, you know, charge me with perjury. I hope you do, you ass, because you know everything that I own. You've been through my home. You've got my cars. Well, they had them. They released them. And you've got my storage bins, so you know everything that I've got in the world. So where do you think I'm hiding assets at? My girlfriend's on welfare, and I live in a dumpy farmhouse, you know? The place was a shack. I mean, don't get me wrong. It was a dump. I appreciate Melvin renting it to me, but it was a dump.
Second, even under the state's plan theory, could Freeman have made it from the community college at 9 a.m. to the karate studio in Escanaba at noon? Colin checked with John Minali, the owner of the karate studio.
And what do you think about this specific theory they presented at trial that he could have chartered this plane from the Upper Peninsula to commit this crime and then fly back in time to see you at the karate studio?
I don't really see how that would be possible.
Uh-huh.
The airport in Escanaba is all the way across town, unless it was a jet, and I don't know, Escanaba could take jets or something like that. How could he have possibly gotten back in that amount of time is just beyond me. And the theory they came, you know, could he have used his ninja capabilities? I mean, what, teleport?
So, putting aside teleportation, let's put the prosecution to their paces, starting by working backwards. Richard Krueger saw the man the state claims is Frederick Freeman outside the community college at 8:01 a.m. If it took at least 4 minutes for Freeman to get from the car he drove to where Krueger saw him, we're at 7:57 a.m. The drive from the St. Clair Airport would have been 50 minutes, which takes us to 7:07 a.m. Let's be conservative and say it took 10 minutes to deboard the plane and get to the car, taking us to 6:57 a.m. Using Evans's quicker flight, it's an hour and 37 minutes in the air, taking us to 5:20 a.m. Would Freeman be able to charter a private single-engine plane to take off at 5:20 a.m. from northern Michigan on a sub-zero November morning? Seems doubtful. Now let's look at the other end. Scott Macklin was shot at 9 a.m. at the St. Clair Community College. Again, it's a 50-minute drive from the community college to the St. Clair Airport, which takes us to 9:50 a.m. Let's again be conservative and say it takes 10 minutes to get in the plane and prepare for takeoff, taking us to 10 a.m. Using Evans's quicker flight, it's an hour 37 in the air, taking us to 11:37 a.m. Again, add another conservative 10 minutes to deboard the plane and get to a car, which takes us to 11:47 a.m. Finally, add another 10 minutes or so to get across town to Choi's Black Belt Academy, and we're at 11:57 a.m. Then, add a few minutes to get out of the car and into the karate studio, taking us to noon, which is when or shortly after the karate witnesses said that Freeman arrived.
So is it possible that the state's timeline works? Maybe, just barely, if everything works out perfectly? But wait, the karate witnesses saw Freeman with his fiancée, Michelle Woodworth. So either Freeman had his very pregnant girlfriend waiting for him at the airport or the karate studio, or Freeman had to make a trip to and from Rock, Michigan, adding another 80 minutes to the state's fictional timeline, blowing it up entirely. You might wonder then how the jury adopted the state's theory. Well, according to one juror, it was more likely they rolled over. We mentioned Bill Proctor earlier, and here's part of one of his news stories about the Freeman case.
But 12 jurors, including this man, Richard Pellegrin, believed that it was possible, as the prosecutor theorized, that Freeman, despite having so little cash he couldn't pay his rent, somehow found the money to charter a private plane to fly in, commit the murder, and fly back north to set up his alibis. Mr. Pellegrin admits that no evidence of such a flight was ever presented in court.
But they never showed you a pilot?
No, sir.
And they never showed you a plane?
No, sir.
And they never showed you how it really happened?
No, sir. It was circumstantial. It was all circumstantial. We have no evidence.
But there's something that the jury didn't know about Robert Evans, the state's witness regarding the plane theory. And there's also something the jury didn't know about the only key witness for the state that we haven't mentioned yet. And there are a few key things the jurors didn't know also about defense counsel David Dean. Next time on Undisclosed.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Undisclosed. I'd like to thank the following people: Rebecca Lavoie for audio production, Christy Williams for website management, Mital Telhan, our executive producer. Of course, I'd like to thank our sponsors. As always, you can support us at our Patreon site at patreon.com/undisclosedpod, and you can follow us at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle @undisclosedpod.
To modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com. Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.